for medical dental. Schaff, I'm sorry.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Rod Moody. I represent the appellant in this matter, Ms. Schaff. It's a fairly straightforward matter.
Do you want to reserve any time?
I'll reserve 2 minutes. Thank you. This matter came before Judge Ellis basically with two questions. One, whether Washington had jurisdiction. That issue is not before this court today. She ruled, I would agree properly, that Washington may exercise jurisdiction over this particular matter. She then, however, addressed...
We have one question in front of us, and that's whether the trial court properly applied the priority of action rule.
Which is exactly where I'm going, and that is correct. And that is, I would respectfully submit, where she made a mistake. The priority action rule requires conformity amongst the subject matter, the parties that are involved, and the relief requested. While there is no dispute that...
If there was a legal decision that your client was not an employee of Retriever, would any of the claims asserted in the Washington complaint remain viable?
I'm sorry, I want to make sure I understand your question. Can you give that to me one more time, please?
Sure. If a court determined as a matter of law that your client was not an employee of Retriever, but instead was an independent contractor, would any of the causes of action alleged in the Washington complaint remain viable?
Certainly the Consumer Protection Act would remain viable.
How so?
Because that addresses issues regarding the public. The public in this particular case are all the independent representatives of this particular company. And so the CPA claim would exist independent. The equitable estoppel claim, which is, of course, a case based on equity regarding non-payment, having to pay back these, in quote, residuals that they are requesting, that would remain. The retaliation claim, and I will freely acknowledge in the complaint I cited to 4948210, that's a mistake. You can't quite that, quote that statute in this context. But you can whack 296-128-030. So I quoted the wrong statutory body, and there's actually an administrative code, but that addresses it more appropriately. That would certainly exist. The manner in which the quote, residuals were pulled back in 296 would require, for example, the employer to pull that back within 90 days. This is well beyond that period of time. So this employer...
Well, don't they have to be an employer for that rule to apply?
Do they have to be an employer for that rule to apply? Yes, that typically generally...
Well, that would assume necessarily then an employee-employer relationship, which I asked you to assume was already established not to exist.
All right. Well, that would certainly apply in the context of the employer-employee relationship. I understand and agree with the court's question.
And in the New York action, Retriever asked the court to declare that your client had the status of an independent contractor and not that of an employee. Is that correct?
That is, frankly, the one common cause of action between these two parties.
So
Retriever has asked...
Yes, they did ask for that relief in New York.
Yes, they're asking for that relief, and we are asking for a determination that, in fact, she is not. That is the one common cause of action that exists between these parties.
And isn't that the core question in both cases?
No. And it is not, because you have damages which flow from arguably a wrongful termination situation that has occurred here, the wrongful, if you will, revocation of this particular contract. But of course, we don't entirely know what contract we have, because we had six contracts that were signed within a six-month period of time, some which have no citation to a venue or a clause, some which choice of law is Texas and venues in Texas, some which has choice of law is New York and venue is New York. So which one applies? And there is no new consideration granted to Ms. Schaff for the signing of any of these contracts. So arguably, the only contract that frankly applies is the first one, which had no choice of law and no choice of venue clause. Because subsequent to that, you have no new additional consideration. No new consideration in the employment context or in this situation, in the contractual relationship as a independent contractor, you don't get to modify the contract. But she was required to. So we have all these conflicts. And I would also point out to the court, quite frankly, the American Mobile case, where the court specifically addressed when one party uses priority action rule as a preemptive type strike. I'm negotiating with an attorney in New York trying to resolve this matter short of litigation. A notice is filed in New York. Not a lawsuit, no facts, no complaints, just a two-page document that took an assistant 5 minutes to prepare that says we intend to file a lawsuit. That is what the priority action rule is based upon. Ms. Schaff filed her complaint 5 days here in Washington State, 5 days prior to the action in New York being filed.
To the complaint being filed.
The complaint being filed, correct.
What's the legal underpinning of this rule? Is it one of comity or something else?
If you look at the authority, it deals a lot with the issues regarding res judicata, collateral estoppel. It deals with the issue of judicial economy.
But, I mean, judicial estoppel and res judicata can't be the beginning point for the rule because the point the rules applied, neither court usually has decided the case. We're sorting out who gets to proceed to decide the case.
And that's what it comes down to. Judicial economy, we're not trying to duplicate efforts. I mean, that's the underlying pinning of this particular rule. But, and that's why you have to have the same subject matter, the same parties, the same relief requested. Here you've got the same parties, but everything else is different.
Rule of equity or a rule of law?
Pardon me?
Is it a rule of equity or a rule of law?
I believe it's a rule of law. I mean, it has equitable principles, and you could certainly argue it in both fashions, but it certainly is a rule that's recognized, you know, well, at least in New York and Washington State, I can tell you that.
Well, and most everywhere else.
Yeah, I'm not trying to exclude every place else, yes.
What evidence in the record was presented to the trial court about the preemptive strike or some form of misconduct? Was that in front of the trial court?
That's actually in our, which trial court?
Washington.
Washington.
Here. Yes, there was evidence of the notice and the summons that was presented to Judge Ellis.
Was there evidence that there was some sandbagging or somehow misleading you into thinking that litigation was being delayed while settlement talks continued?
There certainly was a declaration from my client that, in fact, efforts were being made to resolve this. That certainly was argued to Judge Ellis.
Was there any evidence, there was any discussion, we'll both agree to stay away from the courthouse while we talk?
No, there was no discussion ever along those lines. Nor was that argument ever made. I would point out one interesting point. If the court looked at the ruling out of New York, the court in New York looks at the facts and states that a summons and complaint was filed in October. The court in New York is mistaken as a matter of fact. No complaint was filed. It was a summons and notice. So the court in New York is misunderstanding the factual basis that was before.
Is there any legal significance to that difference under New York's rules for when and how you commence an action?
You know, the rule says that the first to lock in jurisdiction. It doesn't say complaint. Oh, I will concede that point.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. The question that the court raised in counsel's oral argument as to the determination of whether or not Ms. Schaff's an employee or an independent contractor is one that will end up being decided under New York law. The parties have agreed.
Now, that wasn't really the question. The question is that dispositive of all of the issues alleged in the Washington complaint? And counsel answered no and identified at least two causes of action he said would survive that determination. Do you agree?
Probably technically yes. But the core of this action is compensation and wage claims. And the respondent commenced their action in October of 15. The appellant commenced their action in December of 15. The appellant's counterclaims in the New York matter are indistinguishable from the claims that they asserted in their complaint filed in the Washington matter.
Including the CPA claim?
I believe so. I would need to confirm that with the record.
And can you pursue a Washington CPA claim under New York law?
What the New York court could apply Washington law
but
for a CPA claim.
Even though it's applying New York law to determine some of the other issues?
That would be true, yes.
Okay.
The dispute here, I mean, for a priority of action, we look at which action was filed first. Commonality of subject matter. There's clearly a commonality of subject matter. There's wages. This is about compensation. That's the core of this case. Identity of the parties. They're the same parties. Relief, wages, payment of money. Those are the three criteria. After they filed their action in Washington, the appellant, through counsel in New York, tried to have that matter dismissed, and the New York court denied that motion, ultimately retained jurisdiction. My client filed in New York a motion for summary judgment, dismissing all of appellant's claims on the basis that New York law applies. That motion was granted, and that occurred while this case was on appeal.
Is that in our record?
I submitted this as additional authorities.
I understand that, but is that the sort of thing that's appropriate as additional authorities, or is that a request to supplement a record?
I was not certain. And
you haven't asked us to supplement the record. You simply filed the statement of additional authorities.
Yes, as it was a decision.
And is there an appeal pending of that New York decision?
Not to my knowledge. Applying the priority of action rule here and the question of whether the trial court erred in its application of that, I think it's fairly clear that the trial court correctly applied the priority of action rule and that the principles that are underlying that rule, as far as inconsistent decisions and inconsistent results, support a denial of the appeal here.
Was the issue raised in the Washington court about the preemptive strike or some form of misconduct attendant to the sandbagging or anything like that?
No. It wasn't. I mean, I don't believe there's anything in the record to that regard.
Settlement discussions were pending?
Not to my knowledge, no. I have nothing further.
Okay, thank you.
I have 2 minutes and I'll be brief. The issue regarding that you just asked, Your Honor, can New York pursue essentially a CPA or Consumer Protection Act claim under the laws of New York? I make no claim to be an expert on New York law, but my understanding is that New York has no Consumer Protection Act.
Well, that wasn't quite my question. My question was whether you could ask the court to apply Washington's CPA statute in a New York cause of action.
Yes, you certainly can, and that demonstrates exactly the prejudice that my client has experienced. Because the court in New York has essentially ruled, you have this representation agreement, and the interests of the parties under New York law are locked in all completely with under that agreement. So if there is an issue that does not address it, so all issues in New York have to fall within the terms of this representation agreement. By definition, when we look at Hangman Ridge, when we look at the five elements of a Consumer Protection Act, it's not about this particular company versus Shaft. The CPA claim, which is essentially a private Attorney General Act, which is permitted under the case law, addresses the interests of the public. So what the court in New York has said is that I'm going to dismiss this.
Let me back up. It's a private Attorney General statute that allows you to pursue things that concern the public, but you also have to have your own harm or damage that falls within the definition of damage of the statute to be an appropriate plaintiff.
That is true, and Ms. Schaff does. The problem that the New York court has, which demonstrates the prejudice that Ms. Schaff experiences, and we haven't even talked about witnesses and all those issues, but they're in the brief, and I know the court understands those. But the prejudice that exists here is that that CPA claim extends beyond Ms. Schaff. But the court in New York says, no, everything that's contained between Retriever and Ms. Schaff is contained within this representation agreement, therefore I'm going to dismiss the CPA claim.
Is that because of the integration clause in the contract?
I'm sorry, what?
Is that because of an integration clause in that contract?
No, it's because there's some authority in New York, and I've briefed this and I've researched it in New York. There's some authority in New York that talks about if you
the
make
no it. No is a sufficient answer.
Thank you, Parsley.
Thank you.